而三阶级接点宝宝三阶级古松图松别原的原地之外的两个就变成贵原的那三阶级古按这个城市上不松就在你的别上不继续肩膀固定的需要的是就是那三阶级古你这样的那水那这样这个距离啊改的去没理想的啊这个什么的地区这些都是三阶级古原的那三阶级的那三阶级松下的原点的那三阶级因为民盟部这个那些主要民主的两三级是这个主要水平啊三级级就是各级积累啊那这个加上这几年什么的连加上说这都是现在人员那样给定的送给人定的需要的现在定的啥的三级级三级送的民盟是为他原来定的需要的三级级都是现在那个是需要的大家
Good evening. We were looking last time at the qualities of the founder teacher, the founder teacher's the Buddha's body, speech, and mind. Of the three, we looked at the first two. The qualities of a Buddha's body includes that whomever just sees the Buddha, joy arises in their mind, let alone meets or encounters the Buddha. This will lead to the joy arising in beings.And in terms of many qualities of the speech of a Buddha, what we saw briefly last week is how in a single utterance, a Buddha can answer various questions of a limitless number of beings. So these were just a brief presentation of the many qualities of a Buddha's body and speech.
Dös kevar yore. Sanji yika, do, sutra, sechorva, dos sechorva, dine sanji yusun, dös kevar yore, istiyorsan. Ama sanji yusun, ka, ka tangı su. Ka tangı. Mare mare.The order says, the Gasha, the Gatang. The order, Gabby order. Gaji Gatang, the Galagor, the indicated it, Gasidiroa order said, Rod. Gabby Gatti says, your order.
So there are three words that we should look at in the context of the Buddha's speech that have slightly differing meanings. So the first is that of orders or instructions.The second is that of sutras, and the third then is that of speech itself.
So
the first term to look at of these three is the Tibetan is sung, which is the honorific word for speech. So when this is used, it is specifically referring to when the Buddha is talking and others are hearing. So Geshe said just before this.These three terms we'll find in the texts, but they are used differently, and that's what he's bringing out now. So the first term is speech, another will be instructions, and the third will be sutra.
Gaje, Dore, Sungre, Sanji, Shin, Basunya, Chusun, Jorwa, Kanaba, Gish, Sunya, Jorwa, Jisungi, Sanji, Sungre, Sanji, Gaje, Sanji, Dore, Selakor, Tasunga.
So, of these three, if something is, so this word again, Sung, so the speech of a Buddha, this can also be. A sutra as well as an instruction. So these that's two alternative words, that of instruction or order, that and sutra can be used interchangeably with the word for speech. So whilst if something, the word for speech is used, we can also use the word for instruction or sutra. It's not necessarily the case with the other two, because where this word for speech is used, it necessarily refers to the Buddha himself talking and others hearing. But if we take something like the Heart Sutra, the Heart Sutra is a sutra. It can also be called an order or an instruction. But this is not speech of the Buddha, because it is a sutra that came about due to the blessings of the Buddha. Hence, it's a conversation. The Heart Sutra is a conversation between Chenrezig and Shariputra. The Buddha himself wasn't involved in that dialogue. Therefore, it's not called speech, but it is called a sutra and can also be called an instruction. So there are many other sutras which came about due to the blessing of the Buddha, but not delivered by means of his own speech, like the Heart Sutra being one. So such sutras are, of course, suitable to be called sutras or instructions or orders, but not to be called speech. So that's just starting with tonight with a general point. I don't know how well this comes across in translation, because these words may well not be translated in a differing manner or in a way that's explicitly clear. So there, you may well in your reading come across a discussion as to whether the Heart Sutra or any other similar sutra is suitable to be called the speech of the Buddha, because the sutras such as the Heart Sutra were not speeches by the Buddha, but rather came about through the blessings of a Buddha, and blessings of the Buddha. And in this particular sutra, it was a conversation between Shariputra and Chenrezig. So what we see from this is that a sutra does not necessarily have to be spoken by the Buddha, but it's sufficient for it to have come about through the blessings of the Buddha.
Yeah.
So of the three qualities of the Buddha, we've looked at two. We looked last week at the qualities of Buddha's body and the Buddha's speech. So tonight we'll come to the third, that of the Buddha's mind. So in the handout, it's in the top of page 121, and in the published book, near the bottom of page
103. 那土语言的,从于这里啊,那,谦卑语言的,自由语言的,这些,我都是呢,那土语言的,把它开发了,你前呢,那你谦卑语言的,自由语言的,这些,什么的嘛。So
we see that the excellent qualities of the Buddha's mind has two divisions. So reading from Lama Tsongkhapa, this has two points, the excellent qualities of his exalted knowing, and the excellent qualities of his loving kindness, or more accurately, or better translated as his compassion.
Looking
at the first of the two outlines, the excellent qualities of his exalted knowing. Since all objects of knowledge, ultimate and conventional, are engaged by the sage's unobstructed exalted knowing, like a myrobalan fruit placed in the palm of his hand, the sage's exalted knowing covers all objects of knowledge. However, others' limited knowing cannot cover the vast extent of objects to be known. All objects of knowledge can be divided into these two parts or two types, those which are ultimate and those which are conventional. Ultimate refers solely to emptiness or reality, and then conventional refers to all other existence, everything else that exists. So therefore, all objects of knowledge have these two divisions. The nature of how conventional objects exist, that's the ultimate, and then the conventional objects of knowledge. Ultimate object of knowledge refers to just a single object, and that is the emptiness of inherent existence. So it's rather a limited category. But the other category, that of conventional, this is extensive. So everything that is permanent or impermanent, everything that is comprised of form or of matter, all beings within the lower realms or the higher realms, including the varying gods and so forth, all of these are included within the conventional. Well, another way to express it, everything that has come about, independence and causes and conditions. So the category that is ultimate is just the single expression of the emptiness of all phenomena, emptiness of inherent existence, but the conventional, this is extensive. Then an illustration is given of how a Buddha engages with the objects of knowledge. This is are engaged by the sage's unobstructed, exalted knowing, like a myrobalan fruit, or you'll see in the notes, another term is used, and anakalaya. So apparently the myrobalan is just the category of fruit, with one illustration being that of the analaki. So what it refers to is a medicinal fruit that is grown in India, that is found in India, and is used in both Ayurvedic and Tibetan medicine. And it's a fruit, one of the types, the analaki, which is one type, and is likened to a gooseberry in that it's got a very thin skin. And you can see a very thin skin that you can see through and see the actual flesh of the fruit. So a Buddha can observe all objects of knowledge clearly in the same way that we would see a fruit in the palm of our hand. In particular, a fruit with such a thin skin whereby nothing is hidden. You could see into it. So this is likened, for example, our limitation in terms of sight. We can see a front of a building, but we cannot see the rear of the building. Or we can see a person, but we cannot see what's hidden behind the person. A Buddha doesn't have any such obstruction. A Buddha can see all phenomena, all conventional phenomena, as well as the ultimate way of abiding. All are clearly known to the Buddha. So as clearly as we directly perceive something, a Buddha perceives all phenomena. There's nothing that is hidden or obscured to a Buddha's exalted wisdom. So here we should understand this, the term knowing and realizing as having the same meaning. If you know something, you can realize it, but you cannot realize something that you do not know. So therefore, the Buddha knowing all phenomena means all phenomena are realized. The understanding that the Buddha has, the knowledge a Buddha has, the realization the Buddha has, is completely unmistaken in relation to everything. Again, I'll just repeat what he said. So a moment ago, because I made an error, so I'll just correct that. So where I used the word realized, that wasn't what Genda said. He rather was saying obstructed. So just that, and what I said in the previous segment, everything to, if you know something, you realize something, ignore that. So what Genda is saying is, it's just what the text says here, that the knowledge of a Buddha is unobstructed. And then Genda earlier gave the illustrations of how for ourselves, so much is obstructed. And we can't see what's something behind something else. A Buddha faces no such obstruction, not just from the sense consciousnesses, but from the mental consciousnesses too. All is known, nothing is obscured, even to a slight degree. And so therefore there is nothing that can obstruct the knowledge of a Buddha. A Buddha is free of all obscuration, and therefore all is known. The sentence concludes with, the sage's exalted knowing covers all objects of knowledge. So covers, or the Tibetans literally pervades all objects of knowledge, which means there is nothing that is unknown. So for ourselves, we come into this world not knowing too much, but we gain an education, we learn a lot, and we come to many things that were unknown to us become known. But there is still a vast amount across an extensive array of fields of knowledge that to us are completely unknown. So if we were delving into studying a text, we could perhaps learn a large portion of it, but to know everything, every single page and all the meanings, that's unlikely. So in this way, we can see for us, our knowledge is not all pervasive. There are many obstructions to our knowledge. But for a Buddha, there is no such obstruction. The knowledge of a Buddha pervades everything that can be known. So now we come to the word realized. So what this meaning of this end of the sentence, the sage's exalted knowledge covers all objects of knowledge, means that everything that can be known is known, and how it is known is directly realized. In other words, there's no avail of lack of clarity relating to anything that can be known. It is all known directly. Tsongkhapa continues, however, others' limited knowing cannot cover the vast extent of objects to be known. Others here we should understand as referring to great beings such as arhats and Arya Bodhisattvas. So these are remarkable beings who have achieved a radical transformation of their mind. But yet, there are still veils of obscuration for them. There are still things that are to be clearly, completely known. So therefore, they cannot compare to their wisdom cannot compare to the wisdom or the exalted knowledge of a Buddha. Because for a Buddha, everything is completely or perfectly, completely known, and it's directly realized. So everything is known without any veil of hindrance. Whereas for great beings, in comparison, their knowing is limited when compared to the Buddha. So this term, object of knowledge, this just talk as a translator. Objects of knowledge is just a very literal translation, better understood as that which can be known. This objects of knowledge or that which can be known. So now to come to Agenda's saying. So in our world, there are and have been many remarkable beings, great beings who have done a lot of good in the world, and beings also with remarkable inner qualities. So if we think of non-Buddhist teachers of a doctrine other than the Buddha, there their teachings, what they presented, has done a lot of good for beings. However, to those great teachers, there are still things which are unknown. There are still veils or obscurations in their knowledge. For example, they assert that something that does not exist to exist. This is that they assert there is a self-existent self. So therefore, selflessness is completely obscure to them. It's unknown to them. Such great beings whose teachings bring a lot of good in the world, they do not know all that can be known. For example, the presentation of selflessness. But this isn't something restricted just to non-Buddhists. Amongst the many great teachers within Buddhism, those who hold views that are not of the Prasangika, so those remarkable beings who have the views of the Svatantika or the Chittamatrans or the Sautantikas or Pabhashikas, whilst these are remarkable beings, their knowledge has a veil to them, is veiled or is obscured in that they have yet to realize emptiness. There is an obstruction to their knowledge. So as bodhisattvas grow and develop as practitioners, they move through the grounds of, or through the paths of ordinary bodhisattvas, eventually entering into the paths and then the grounds of the Arya bodhisattvas. So as these remarkable beings, the bodhisattvas, grow and develop spiritually, ever more of what was unknown to them becomes known, or what was to be realized, ever more is becoming realized. But for much of these training paths, these bodhisattvas, there is far more to be realized than has been realized. But as they move through the bodhisattva grounds, they are coming to realize ever more. However, so then when we think about, so what is the position of the 10th level bodhisattva, or the bodhisattva on the 10th ground. So these are the beings in the last period of their existence as an ordinary being, their last period as unenlightened beings. So for them, everything has been known, but not, or realized, but not yet directly. It is a Buddha and a Buddha alone that can perceive all phenomena as clearly as we can see a piece of fruit in one's hand. It's only a Buddha who can perceive all phenomena directly, or realize all phenomena directly. Even the 10th ground bodhisattva has realized, whilst the 10th ground bodhisattva has realized all phenomena have yet to be realized directly. It's only a Buddha who has done this.
As
Lama Tsongkhapa is prone to do, he then presents quotations as a source for what he has just stated. So looking at the first verse from Praise of the One Worthy of Praise, only your wisdom encompasses all objects of knowledge. For everyone else apart from you, some objects are yet to be known. This is just what has been presented above. So look in the first two lines. Only your wisdom encompasses all objects of knowledge. So here, Lama Tsongkhapa stating, what's been quoted here by Lama Tsongkhapa asserts what was stated above. It's only for Buddhas that everything is realized directly. Everything that can be known is known without exception.
The
third and fourth line as just was finally presented in the last few sentences by Lama Tsongkhapa. For everyone else apart from you, some objects are yet to be known. So those who are not yet Buddhas, wherever they are in their spiritual journey, whether they've developed a path, a mental path yet or not, or if they have developed a mental path, how developed that path may be, for all beings yet to attain a path or on the training paths, there are still objects to be known for them. A Buddha and a Buddha alone knows everything that can be known.
Chenam Yodam Yoche, Chida Naso Soso La, Nekala Lunda Yuashi, Chigi Tuda, Chigi Tuda, Tominga, Shesumba, Der Sambahu Osa.
And Lama Tsongkhapa further quotes, "Blessed one, all phenomena throughout time, in every aspect and place of origin, are objects of experience of your mind, like a Marabalan fruit in the palm of your hand. As regards phenomena, static or mobile, single or various, each distinct individual, your mind is obstructed from none of them, like the wind moving across the sky." Okay, the first two lines, "Blessed one, all phenomena throughout time." So this is a particular expression, translated correctly, and it refers to the three times. So everything that has happened, all that is happening right now, and all that will happen, this is known by the Blessed One, by the Buddha, in every aspect and place of origin. So this then refers to the second line, all the causes that have led to these particular results, as well as all the signs and reasons that establish phenomena. All this is known to the Buddha. There is nothing that is hidden from the wisdom of the Buddha. So staying with these two lines. So with the Blessed One, knowing all phenomena throughout time in every aspect and place of origin, what this comes down to is that because everything is known to a Buddha knows when a Buddha observes a result, those causes that led to the result, the multitude of causes leading to a result, are known. Similarly, when causes are accumulated, but the result is yet to come, that too is known. So whether causes were accumulated in this life or lives previous to this, the Buddha knows those causes. And what results are to follow, whether in this life or lives to come, that is known to the Buddha. So this then gives an idea of the expansiveness of a Buddha's knowledge compared to non-Buddhas. The third and fourth line are objects of experience of your mind, like a Mirabalan fruit in the palm of your hand. So for us in English, the fourth line, this then it presents the example Lama Tsongkhapa referred to earlier. And then for us, our third line, objects of experience of your mind. So this expression, objects of experience, we should understand as mean, or experience here, we should understand to mean realize. So, or directly realize rather. So therefore, everything, all objects of knowledge, everything that is, that can be known, is directly realized by a Buddha. Looking at the third verse, as regards phenomena, static or mobile, single or various, each distinct individual. Here again, the phenomena are being divided in another manner. So before we had in terms of the three times in every aspect and origin. Yes, in terms of being static or mobile, single or various, each distinct individual. So again, it's a way of dividing everything that exists and to establish that the Buddha knows all phenomena. So these terms, static or mobile. So mobile refers to that which moves. So the Tibetan literally is moving and unmoving. That which moves has life or is animate. So it refers to sentient beings, or beings rather. Mobile refers to beings, those who have consciousness. Static refers to the inanimate, so that which lacks consciousness. So everything that lacks consciousness or has consciousness, whether in its as a single or as a group, all of this is known perfectly.
Yoda 제자
So some may well have doubts about this explanation of static and mobile, because if something is being mobile means that it's animate, it has consciousness, but there are things that move that are inanimate, flowing water. And this particular Tibetan word translated as mobile literally means to move, like the air will move or water flows. So that's literally the word. Translated here as mobile. So to say it refers to something with consciousness, this seems odd, because trees move, water moves, but they are here being classified under the static, when they certainly are not static. So one may well have some questions about this presentation.
In
general, if one comes across the words moving or unmoving, or here static or mobile, this would refer to what we understand in the world. So water flows, trees move in the wind, a hand also waves. So this would, we'd say, are all mobile or moving. But in this context, the meaning is slightly different. It means something that is mobile or animate means that it moves under the influence or under the control of consciousness. It moves through, by means of being propelled by consciousness. Whereas the static or inanimate does not move because there's no consciousness moving it. So that is how these terms should be understood here, and why static refers to the inanimate and mobile to the animate. So therefore, static and mobile refer to the inanimate and the animate, and these are known, as we see in the second line, whether individually or within a collective, a group, and by their own individual characteristics. In the third and fourth line, your mind is unobstructed from none of them, like the wind moving across the sky. So our mind can be likened to the wind trying to enter into this room, but it will be stopped by the windows and walls and roof. So our mind, or the minds of non-Buddhas, have various obstructions. A Buddha's mind is free of all obstructions, and it can be likened then to the wind moving through the sky. When nothing obstructs the wind can just continue to move freely. I just missed in the previous segment. The Buddha's mind being likened to the moving wind through the sky is likened to the Buddha's mind directly realizing everything. There's nothing that obstructs the direct realization of all phenomena. Then Lama Tsongkhapa concludes, recollect in accordance with these words. So to remind ourselves where we are and why we are looking at this. So we, in the context of the topic of a refuge or protecting refuge, in particular in relation to the Buddha. So why do we look here to the Buddha? Because again, as was presented previously, the Buddha has the power to guide one to gain protection from suffering. And this mind that turns to the Buddha for protecting refuge, this is a mind of trust. So the mind of refuge is a mind of trust. The deeper, more heartfelt, more stable that mind of trust is in the Buddha, the deeper, more stable, more heartfelt one's refuge is. So how to generate a deep and abiding refuge is through thinking about the qualities of, in this instance, the Buddha. Because it's through thinking about the qualities, but not just merely recalling them, but reflecting on them to the point where one develops deep and abiding awe of the Buddha, then one's trust in the guidance from the Buddha will be deep and heartfelt and transformative.
当然，同学些啊，这个他们点个，送过月的有了，送过月的，退月的开始现在啦，三月有可能是经过的，是的，可能是经过的，那不就可能是结果的，那么可能过不住的，可能是过不了，考了判断线用噻，可能是过不了，过下去做啥子没？实际上，三月经过的，实际上三月嘛，经不见面不的，实际上三月铅笔给的那原来有把印章，那个嘛，他不了他把的，他们就铅笔过往都给。
他们店的东西，他们店吧啦，生意刚刚有嘛，他的，他没办法，其实他店铺过的，原来店的有的，其实，其实他东西是一个女把的生意，都生意，有不的，生意一切的，多没办法的，就给接触过的，可是呢，多没办法，多没办法，搞不了两个就给，电话接完了，没想到啊，这新疆嘛，这就是，根据上他们说，啊，他现在的生意给，没。 三百个多些呢，所以说给哈蟆国外去，以这个一些咱们吃下呢，都接不赢了。但，店里接不的，就话亲戚多些，就接不老爷的，多些要用过了吧。但都是所以说给雇员店里些什么大，胸大的谢谢把那些东西什么大接不接，但是送给员店里些把都是接不接什么大，用不着的，退给员店里用不着什么东西接不接，这都原来的有用不着什么东西接不接，这都原来的有通用的，所以说给俺们用过的，但是呢。
The purpose of this chapter is to develop a mind of trust in the three jewels, yeah, specifically in relation to the Buddha, to develop our mind of trust. So that we are open and receptive and therefore can be guided to radically transform our mind and in that way gain protection from suffering. So in terms of going to refuge to the Buddha, we need to become aware of the various qualities of Buddha's body, speech and mind and reflect well on them. So for example, in relation to the qualities of the Buddha's body, reminding ourselves that the Buddha has no physical impediment. There's no impediment to the Buddha physically appearing anywhere or in any form to be of benefit. The Buddha can and does manifest anywhere in whatever manner beings require. On the Buddha side, there is no impediment. And then in terms of the Buddha's speech, the Buddha possesses the quality of being able to communicate flawlessly without hesitation, delay, or impediment. There's no impediment such as language or a communication style that some people may be more receptive to than others. And moreover, the way the Buddha communicates leads to the immediate arisal of delight in all who hears the speech of a Buddha. And the qualities of the Buddha's mind, in particular exalted knowing, which is what we've looked at tonight, is that all objects of knowledge are directly realized. So this expression is perhaps a bit flat, but what it means, all objects of knowledge are directly realized, is everything is directly known to the Buddha, which means the Buddha has faultless understanding of our situation, of our problems, of our difficulties. With this faultless understanding, it's not merely an understanding that our lives are difficult, but the faultless understanding of why our lives are difficult, all the causes that each individual being has individually created since beginningless time. So those are all individual objects of knowledge, all are known. And with that knowledge, and with the wisdom of the Buddha being unobstructed, the Buddha therefore knows the perfect methods and solutions for each individual being to overcome each problem, suffering, and difficulty. And the Buddha knows how to guide beings to overcome these problems in the short term and the long term, or the temporary solutions and the ultimate solution. This is all known to the Buddha. This is the very meaning of knowing all objects of knowledge. So why we need to reflect on this is because we often are either the recipients of others' advice, or we may turn to someone for advice. We have a problem and we want someone's advice for a solution. But to the extent we lack trust in that person, we will listen with some suspicion, some doubt in our mind. And in terms of following that advice, we'll have hesitation. So we may like the person, we may trust them. Their advice may be well-intentioned. And perhaps not only well-intentioned, but their advice is actually in this instance flawless. So following it would be the wise thing to do. But because our trust is limited, also our knowledge is limited, we will be hesitant. We'll have doubts. So this, in terms of the Buddha, we need to overcome to be truly receptive to his intervention and guidance. So this is the very purpose here. The very purpose is to come to rely on the Buddha, recognizing that he has perfect knowledge of our problems, their causes, and their solutions. It's difficult for us to really perceive just how different a Buddha is from ourselves. Because across lifetimes, we've made effort to learn things, and even now when we learn something new, there's perhaps a bit of excitement at having as something that was previously unknown now to be being known to one. And a bit of excitement, maybe we want to tell others. But for a Buddha, all of this has long since been known. Everything is known. And there's no, and by known in this context, we should understand it means directly realized. So we may know things, but there are still veils of a lack of knowledge in that field. So we may be knowledgeable in a field, but we are not perfected. Our knowledge in that field is not perfected. For a Buddha, it is, and in every field. So in the same way, it's difficult for us to really perceive what a Buddha is like compared to ourselves. Even the great beings in the world, beings such as bodhisattvas, Arya bodhisattvas, arhats, and even the Arya bodhisattvas on the pure grounds, even they cannot be likened to a Buddha. Even their incredible qualities cannot be likened to that of a Buddha. And thereby, the benefit they can give is nothing compared to that which a Buddha can give. Because their knowledge is still obstructed, obscured, or veiled in some way. And therefore, their understanding of the causes of our problems, the solutions to our problems, there are limits. But for a Buddha, all those limits have been eradicated.
And the type how a pair da na so so yin da da din ni san gi gi yin de din ni shin din na shin yin de de da den but ne ya din na ji to ba ji gi ne ya din na ji ji to ba ji gin sem bi gi da sem shu ge ya je da din ni da san gi yu gu yu yin de de su yu yin de tu yu yin de di pa qian ji jie ba jie xin jie de yin de tong yi de o di yin de din na ji ji ge ya to ba ji gi to ba shu si be sam da yi de je san gi go ba to ba shu sim ge jian shu sem gi go ru da 那你那个原来的那些原来在三九国嘛，你那些人家托班去，身边什么待遇，真是什么，哎，起码对几个人工作了哇，你有，但是你那啥的，朋友，你那个前辈那，朋友帮助没把啥呀，说这个，俺爹俩对你就对吧，学车着呀，上街里啊，对吧，对不着呀，对不对？对的，人家上街有送别个，拉不下来，拉不下来呀，对你就对吧，就学车去用过了，也是，人家都是呢。
I want to encourage you to reflect on the inconceivable qualities of the Buddha's body, speech, and mind. So these qualities, this use of the word inconceivable, is not just a mere a polite expression, but that the qualities of Buddhas are inconceivable to us. But to the extent that we have knowledge and we can understand the qualities of the Buddha, I encourage you to reflect on those qualities. Because by doing so, it will strengthen your heartfelt faith in the Buddha. And this leads to the accumulation of so much merit. But even more importantly is that it leads to the development of trust. This heartfelt trust and receptiveness. This is imperative. It's imperative for many reasons, but I'll highlight one right now. By being inspired by what a Buddha is and what a Buddha therefore can do, that is required to give rise to a determination within you to become a Buddha yourself, to become a Buddha so as to guide all beings to a state freed of suffering, to give rise to this mind of bodhicitta, requires many excellent qualities, some of which include a deep understanding and rejection of suffering and its causes. But also, one requires a deep understanding of the qualities of a Buddha so that one has the wish not merely for oneself to be freed of suffering and a thought of how nice it would be if others were freed of suffering, but whereby one understands just what a Buddha is and what becoming a Buddha means to others, means to one's wish for all beings to be freed of suffering. So therefore, if you hold the aspiration to become a bodhisattva, these meditations on refuge are indispensable. This is the entry point to come to understand more clearly just how remarkable Buddhas are, and thereby give you this courage, strength of mind to give rise to a genuine wish. I also want to become a Buddha. In fact, I have to be. So there's so much benefit that follows from this meditation. So I encourage you, engage in this reflection because it's indispensable to develop this determination to become a Buddha for the sake of others. In other words, bodhicitta.
And ဆုံးပဲလပ်ချက်လျာလပ်ရလပ်ရတွင်ရတွင်ပတ်ကြအနစာကြီးကိုရင်တဲ့တာကိုဆုံးရင်တဲ့ဒီနာရှိခြင်းရာဆန်ရောကဘာဒီနာရှိထောက်ပါချင်းစီပဲချန်ရှိဆင်ကြရဒုစိနံကတော့စံတားရဒီကိုရဲကျန်တဲ့ဒီနေ့သတိကြီးတဲ့မာဆုံးပြီးကြီးဂျေဘုလ်မာဆောတဲ့ငါတို့ကြီးငါတို့ဆင်တဲ့အတွင်းစံတောင်းဝဲတဲ့ဒီချက်ကိုရဲ
So as is always the case, this meditation is one of analysis, an analytical meditation. Here, the particular topic I'm encouraging you now to translate for these periods of weeks that we're covering this chapter is on the qualities of the Buddha's body, speech, and mind. So in the last fortnight, we had the opportunity to reflect on the qualities of the Buddha's body and speech, and now we add to that the mind, in particular, the qualities of his exalted knowing. So I want to encourage you to engage in these meditations in the sequence that we move through the text and not only to engage in meditation topics that draw you. See, in terms of meditating on the qualities of the Buddha, this is imperative to develop your trust and your faith in the Buddha. And why this is so important is because it's through developing faith in the three jewels that will aid our letting go of what is unimportant. All these unimportant things that fill our minds so, to let go of that and rather embrace what is important. This transformation requires many causes, of which a pivotal one is the mind of refuge, where a mind of deep refuge will trust the advice of the Buddha. And therefore, when the advice is to let go of what's unimportant and embrace the Dharma, that which has importance, one will have the strength of mind to do so. And this is that letting go of what's unimportant and embracing what is important is an indispensable prerequisite to engage in all the later trainings, those that will still be presented in the text. So shortly, in the coming weeks, we'll come to the various trainings of refuge, which are there, or precepts of refuge, which are there to help us in this cultivation of deep abiding refuge. And where this trust is required later is by letting go of what's unimportant, embracing what's important, those indispensable qualities of generosity, mind of ethical strength, minds of patience, joyous perseverance, concentration, and wisdom. These, finally, one will be able to develop in a way that is both powerful and abides. So if one looks at one's training of one's mind, and recognizes that perhaps it's not where, ideally, after these years, you'd like it to be, is these preliminary practices that we are covering, it's these that you need to focus on, to develop the foundation for which all great qualities later will arise. So I say this to encourage you to engage in this meditation, to point out very explicitly the benefits of this meditation, to encourage you to do so. With every meditation topic, there are many points in terms of how to meditate that carry across the topics. So when you meditate on something such as refuge, generate a clear understanding of the benefits of doing so, so that you want to engage in it. And then when you do so, intentionally recognize, I've done something important. And afterwards, when you dedicate and you look back, rejoice in what you are doing. This is imperative because it aids the continuity of engaging in these meditations. And so when you do so, when you look at the benefits, include the goals that appeal to you most, whether they are goals of bodhicitta or calm abiding or enlightenment, whatever it is that appeals to you, recognize that these are the preliminaries to those great goals. And do this to make your mind positive, because the positive mind is a determined mind and a mind that will engage in these practices repeatedly over a sustained period.
All right, that is awesome.
Thank you. Thank you. We'll conclude there for tonight.